Okay, Dr. Ex Cathedra sends $10. Thank you very much. According to Burnham, liberals' Achilles heel, re any group that they deem less well-off than themselves, they are morally disarmed. The oppressor class is described as white, male, straight, Christian, patriotic, and now cis, so any group outside that class is victimized and must be embraced. Thoughts? Well, even that, I think, is... And Burnham was an ex-Marxist. He was an ex-Trotskyite. I think that even that is too much of the sort of Marxist mentality at work. It is true that liberals feel disarmed in the face of the needy. I don't know if that's intrinsic to liberalism or if that is Christianity. I mean, a lot of it's Christianity, to be perfectly honest. But a lot of it's just leftism as well. And one of the things that leftism has done is it has taken, and this is something that Gottfried alludes to, it's taken attitudes from Christianity and exploited them, heightened those altruistic sensibilities, and used them to overthrow liberalism. So I guess you can say that that is an Achilles heel of liberal societies. I don't know if it's an Achilles heel of liberalism per se, or if it's something that is there as a deep stratum of Christian sentiment that's ultimately what's at work here. What are your thoughts on this, Pox?
Yeah, I would say that there's a lot of Christianity involved in that. If the statement was that liberalism is undone by its empathy and charity towards the supposed needy, right? I think that could also be, of course, traced to Christianity, but it might have something to do just with the European, the Germanic European spirit. I don't know if it can all be laid at the feet of liberalism itself.
There is a form of liberalism that says, I'm sorry, this is an individualist game. And if you're needy, well, it's all on you. That's the sort of hard-hearted classical liberalism. That's definitely part of liberalism. And when you start getting redistributionist schemes and stuff like that, well, that there is a point when the libertarians say that left liberalism isn't really liberal because it aggresses against the successful to give unearned things to the unsuccessful. So, I mean...
I was going to say, too, I'm not sure if it's an Achilles heel. It just goes back to what I was saying, is that I think liberalism allows for other ideologies to exist within it and grow at revolutionary ideologies. So if you think about the way that cultural Marxism, it's basically a perma-revolutionary ideology. It always has to find another envelope to push. It always has to find another cause, something else to complain about, some other oppressor. Now, in that statement from the donator, he mentioned that first it was white Christian families, and now they've added cis men to the list of oppressors and targets for the new revolution. So, in a way, again, it's back to, it's liberalism that allows this subversive, permanently revolutionary ideology to exist within it. And that's what's really causing the problem here.
Yeah. I think liberalism has to be a little bit illiberal. Ultimately, this is a contradiction. Liberalism is an individualist game. And it can only work by excluding people who play by non-individualist rules, who will try and insert themselves into this game, gain power, and then subvert it. But that means that it has to be a collectivist strategy in the end. And to say, okay, I'm a Northern European, in Northern European in culture and descent. Liberalism works for people like me. it just seems intuitively plausible. We can look back to a time when we were more unconsciously collectivist, and that's the rub of it. We were unconscious of this, when it was working phenomenally well for us. We didn't realize that it depended on certain ethnic preconditions, and that by ignoring these preconditions and just playing the individualist game with all comers, we were undermining the conditions that made that game possible in the long run. And therefore, why can't we simply go back to or reaffirm our basic liberal outlook, which works well for us, but become collectivist about it? Realize that it only works with people like us. And start voting the cheats off our island and become a little bit more collectivist. If you were to, I think that that would be a coherent answer to this problem. And simply say, yes, we would like to maintain as much of our liberal instincts and sentiments and practices as possible. We just have to realize now that we can't include everybody. And so we're going to become self-consciously, ethnically, collectivist liberals. That's totally possible. And that might actually be how the solution unfolds in Western societies.
Certainly, I think it would appeal to a lot of people.
Yeah.
More than some other things are out there.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Okay, so let's look here. Runtz Meadow has written in with $253. That's very generous. Thank you very much. Sunshine Kid, 10 euros. Could you talk for a bit about Bolyakov's and, following him later, Kerry Bolton's reappraisals of Stalin? I believe you've written a review of his work, Stalin, The Forgotten Legacy. Great stream. Thank you very much. I don't have much to add to what I said in the review of the Bolton book. Yaki and Stalin. Okay. One of the best things that Kerry Bolton has written for Countercurrents is his introduction to The Enemy of Europe, the Yaki book, that basically was arguing that the USSR was less of an enemy than the United States in the Cold War. This was not amusing, and ended up having the book being banned and burned by the Western liberal democracy that we had installed in Germany. He lays out how this has to be seen in the context of a charm offensive by Stalin to try and co-opt former Nazis in East and West Germany. I think it's a deeply dishonest book. And it's part, like I said, it's organically part of a larger communist propaganda operation. It's deeply dishonest. Why? Well, he argues, for instance, that he knew about the Katyn massacre, for instance. But he just waves away all these ideas that the communists could sweep in and just murder tens of thousands or millions of people. He covers up for Stalin's crimes to argue basically for lowering the guard towards communist bloc, and instead trying to break Europe away from the United States. I just think it's despicable. It's despicable and dishonest, really, and it's propaganda in the service of a larger Stalinist operation. Anyway, let's see if there's some other questions here for Pox and me. Okay, I'll Take My Stand is written in with $10. Thank you. The problem with Marxism and wokeness is that they are revolutionary. Rather than build on existing natural traditions, institutions, they want to use abstract theory to force impossible changes to human nature. Pox, what do you think of that?
I think that's very well said. I think that's what I was talking about earlier, is that it's a permanent revolution. It has to always search for some new oppressor, some new target, something else to subvert, to change. I suppose E. Michael Jones would call it the Judaic revolutionary spirit. And as you alluded to, Greg, many of the members of the Frankfurt School were Jews. And so it is basically just a sort of Trojan horse for Jewish interests and Jewish desire to reshape society. Charitably speaking, I suppose we could say it's, you know, their desire to tikkun olam, heal the world. Less charitably, we can look at it as their desire to slowly but surely blot out the name of Amalek and, you know, destroy the nations. But yeah, I do think that that is actually a very, very good characterization. It is revolutionary in nature and behavior.
That's well said. I don't have anything to add to that. Visigoth writes in, this question arises after reading Spencer Quinn's wonderful piece on vindicating Jim Watson. Jim Watson, who's in his 90s, is constantly threatened by Cold Spring Harbor that if he speaks his mind on the genetics of intelligence and race, they will evict his family and him from his house, which paradoxically, by the way, he actually donated in the past to Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory. Oh, that's utterly despicable. That's a moral obscenity right there. Do you think men and women would like to know about the lesser amount of intelligence in genes which Africans have and the cover-up of this fact before they date and pick a marriage partner to have children with? Does the average person want to know that they are reducing their chance of having an intelligent child when it's half African? I think they would want to know. I think they would be glad to know. It's astonishing how little people know about genetics. And of course, they're kept in the dark about this. So I do think that, yeah, we should talk about eugenics. And, you know, as soon as you start that path, you know, going down the path of talking about eugenics and saying, well, you know, if you have a kid with this Asian lady who's very nice and very agreeable, you know, the kid's not going to have your blue eyes, not going to have your stature, not going to have a lot that would make it possible for you to see yourself in this kid. And the same thing if you're contemplating mating with an African. There is a grave problem that people have with mixed race children. They don't see enough of themselves in them. This is especially true with white people who have recessive traits. And so, you know, you have white plus Asian and it looks like an Asian, or white plus black and it looks more black than white. It's hard for people who are white to see themselves in their offspring with people of other races. And that lowers their sense of kinship with their own children. It lowers the intelligibility that they feel that their children have. And the reason for this is because of genetic similarity. If you have children with somebody of your own kind, what that means is that the child will not just have 50% of the same genes that you have. The child will have more than 50% of the same genes, because you and your partner, if you belong to the same group, have a lot of genes in common as well. Whereas if you have children with people who are genetically very dissimilar to you, you will have less in common with your children, literally genetically less in common with your children. And we know that genetic similarity is the foundation of harmonious relationships in individual relationships and social relationships. So yeah, there's a lot of basic eugenics that people need to know about to shape their decisions. Unfortunately, there are very few people who inquire about this. And I have a funny story. The first person I ever met who actually advocated eugenics was a sports-obsessed guy in suburban Atlanta who dreamed, he was a white guy, who dreamed of marrying a black and spawning superior athletes. And I just shook my head and I thought, well, that's his value system, I suppose. But that was the first encounter I ever had with a eugenicist. And I think most eugenicists, though, would want their kids to be brighter and also have like closer relationships with their children. And so race mixing doesn't accomplish that. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, as far as what the normie thinks about this, I couldn't imagine. I sometimes even think of just giving up on trying to understand where normies are at on certain issues. And that was a good anecdote that you just gave there, because a person who doesn't have a problem with mixed race kids or having a mixed race family, they've probably gone too far. Nothing's going to convince them otherwise. But now if the question is, the question was, you know, could you dissuade someone from it by telling them about the negative effects it would have on the IQ of your child? Would that work? So if we imagine a situation like, you know, I have to tell my daughter, you know, I don't really think you should marry and have children with a black man, or tell my son that he shouldn't marry and have children with a black woman or an Asian woman. You know, don't go out of the European race. I would suppose that there's a plethora of, you know, ideas that you could use. I think a lot of mixed race kids are just ugly. So there's the aesthetic argument. The idea they wouldn't look like you. But then again, be surprised to see how many normies just don't care about that. It doesn't matter, you know, to them. All that matters to them is, I love this person and I want to have a family and children with them. And I suppose that if you were to give a woman the arguments against race mixing, focusing on IQ, I'm not so sure that a woman would care as much about that. That seems very, I don't know. It seems a bit too cold. I think a woman might care more about the way their child looks and the connection that she'll have, you know, staring into, he's got my eyes, right? He's got my blue eyes or my blonde hair. Maybe that would be a better tact, but I'm not so sure. The normies never cease to amaze me with some of the things they believe.
Yeah, just basic stuff they don't understand anymore. Just absolute basic stuff. And
repulsed at the idea that how could you not love a mixed race child? How could just let people love and have families? And if you try to say, well, there are reasons that I am against this, not just because I don't like, it has nothing to do with hating other groups. It's there are reasons here. They don't understand it.
I don't advocate not loving your race mixed children. What a strange attitude. I don't advocate loving. I don't say that you ought to love or not love anything. Okay. I'm not Jesus. Okay. I'm not coming around telling you how you should feel. I do want to point out, though, that as an objective fact, that you will feel less affection and kinship with your half black or half Asian child than you would with an entirely white child. That's just a fact.
And maybe that from the child's perspective, saying that the child is going to have feelings of, you know, who am I? What exactly am I? You know,
they will be alienated.
Already married someone from another race, and they're thinking about having children. You know, it's too late for me to say, no, you know, don't be in love with your wife or husband or whatever. But as far as the effects of a mixed race child, I can't say whether or not they would have a connection to their child. I don't know. It's interesting to explore that. But I'm pretty sure, based on many experiences, that mixed race children, and I'm sure we've all observed this, they grow up with these confused identities and sensibilities. And oftentimes they just choose, in the case of like a black-white family, they just choose the black identity and end up being very resentful about their white side. And I don't think that's healthy for a child to have that weight on their soul and on who they are. So maybe you should think about that before you go off and have, you know, a mixed family and, you know, marry and have children with someone from another race. Think about the consequences of that for the children, your potential children.
Think about the children.
Exactly.
So I have a question from Slushied, who wants to know, do we think that traditional religious injunctions against pride and vanity are a necessary way of cracking down on narcissism, or they, do they prevent people from having the confidence to achieve their potential? What do you think of that? Is our Christian virtue, you know, let's just talk about Christianity. Christianity has religious injunctions against pride and vanity. Is this good for cracking down on narcissism, or is it bad because it prevents people from having the confidence to achieve their potential?
Yeah, I like this question. So I think that there's a fair criticism to be made of Christianity. And I know that the word meek, interpreted as not weak, but basically just someone who knows self-control. But, you know, the Bible verse is that the meek shall inherit the earth, blessed are the peacekeepers, pride comes before the fall, etc., etc. And if you compare that with sort of Nietzschean philosophy and the idea of the Übermensch, well, then you have something quite different. And I think that one of the reasons why Western civilization, to use that broad term, is in this sort of period of stagnation and decadence is because we don't have much of a vitalistic spirit of go out and do something, be someone. A lot of our Faustian spirit has been channeled into business ventures. But for most people, life is sedentary. Life is working in an office somewhere for a corporation that doesn't really care about you. Your job is not that essential. You're easily replaced. And I think this is perhaps one of my more controversial ideas, but I think at a time when, in particular, men and young men are wallowing in despair, living these lives of quiet desperation, they're not getting any. They have no chests, no muscles. They spend too much time indoors. Their masculine personalities, their masculine tendencies have all been repressed or channeled into something more feminine. The school system basically treats them as defective girls. I don't think the message they need to hear is, you know, be less prideful, you know, be more meek, I guess, be more humble. I think actually these men need to be encouraged to go out and try and make a mark on life. I've said that I think some young men out there could actually do with going out and flirting with girls. Maybe going out and having practice girlfriend instead of this idea of, oh, no, wait for the virgin in the wheat field, right, the trad cath girl. Well, if you don't even know how to talk to girls, if you don't have any social life, if you haven't done anything to make yourself attractive to the opposite sex, how are you going to get that trad cath in the wheat field anyway? You kind of have to go out there, and it's a conundrum. It's a contradiction, but you kind of have to go out there and get a bit dirty, I suppose, if you want to come out on the other side with the confidence necessary to get that prize. Now, people can respond to that any way they want, say, no, I don't agree with that, but I've seen it work for a lot of guys, and I've even seen it work in my own life, that sometimes you just have to shake off this feeling of, I would say, yeah, I guess that puritanical mindset, and actually just, you know, lift your chin up, puff your chest out, and say, no, I actually do want to, I want to do something. I want to make a mark. I want to be Übermensch. And sometimes Christianity gets in the way of that.
Well, I couldn't agree more. I think that talking about meekness and not being proud and stuff like that is the worst possible message for people who have been overly feminized and underparented. A lot of it has to do with just lack of parenting. I wrote an essay called Wallflower Psychology that I urge people to read. It deals with this. I think there are a lot of underparented men out there who feel like before they can make any steps forward in the world, somebody's got to give them something. And that's just their underparented child voice inside of them. Because, of course, we, in a normal upbringing, your parents give you a lot. They supply a lot to you. They capitalize you and they send you forth into the world. And if you didn't get that parenting and you feel incapable or less capable of dealing with the world because of it, you, I think, tend to be sort of retiring, and you think that, damn it, some needs of yours were not met a long time ago, and you're not going to budge until they are, by somebody else who becomes like a parent substitute. Well, first of all, people who are going to be parent substitutes generally don't have your best interest at heart. You're getting into a weird relationship that's probably not good for you. And what has to be done is you've just got to get over this desire to have stuff given to you, to be parented by other people, and you've just got to put yourself out there. You've got to overcome this. And I think a lot of the lack of self-confidence that you have in young men is just lack of parenting and lack of feeling equipped for dealing with society. And so they sort of hang around as wallflowers and nerds waiting for somebody to give them what they needed. Well, at a certain point, you have to just say, you've got to parent yourself. And it's tough. You've been failed. And we have, with each passing generation, you know, I'm over the hill, right? I'm definitely over the hill. And in the past, I understand that as people get older, they would envy the youth. They would envy them, their youth, for one thing. But honestly, I'm glad I'm not a Zoomer. Mm-hmm. I'm glad I'm not a millennial. Because I just see the problems that these people have, the problems that people younger than me have. And I don't want to be burdened with those. I'm glad I'm not burdened with those. I see so many people who are lonely. And they're lonely because, for a lot of reasons.
There's one, many reasons, yeah.
Yeah, lack of parenting. The other is living in increasingly virtualized online worlds where they think that they can have a completely boutique, unique identity. They're encouraged to do this, right? Mm-hmm. Down to all kinds of weird little sexual fetishes and preferences and stuff like that. And then they suddenly find out that there's nobody that they click with. You know, the sense that you have infinite options leads people to never close on anything. And so they're always lonely. I noticed this
a long time ago. It's also a generation that is both the Zoomers, but started with millennials. Maybe it started with Gen X, but it was definitely a defining feature, I think, of millennials and certainly Zoomers, is that there's just a complete loathing of sincerity. Irony reigns supreme. And in particular, in the Zoomers now, it's basically cringe if you care too much about someone else and want to be in a relationship with them. That's cringe. Things are supposed to be casual. You're not supposed to care.
Well, they're just trying to protect themselves.
Exactly. It is a self-defense mechanism.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there's economic reasons as well for why these two generations are so terribly atomized and depressed. Mm-hmm. The lies that we were told about, you know, what should we do? You know, what paths we should take in life. Women pursuing the dream job, told they could have it all, realizing that it's not quite the case. And now, of course, you know, the millennials are getting pretty long in the tooth now. Biological clock is running out of time for this generation, for the women of this generation. And, you know, it's a bit of a meme, invest in cat food, but it's not that funny because there's going to be a lot of lonely people, both men and women. But in particular for women, just as far as natality is concerned, for whom it will be too late. That's, I just think that the ramifications of all of that are massive. It's a pretty big deal. Well, and as far as the pride thing, I just want to say too, is if the question was about pride, whether or not we should be avoiding that or anything. I think one of the best prohibitions of getting, you know, too proud is just living life and failing. So again, going out and trying things, going out and being rejected, going out and, you know, having to work to make ends meet, trying new projects, and then stumbling along the way will teach you a lot about humility. But just believing that you can't be great and that to be great is to, you know, commit the sin of pride, I would advise against that. I think that's a recipe for stagnation and being quite sedentary.
We need the exact opposite message, because mm-hmm. whole culture militates against healthy. There's a lot of unhealthy self-esteem out there, but there's not a lot of healthy self-esteem, healthy self-confidence in these underparented and spoiled kids. And yeah, I do think the idea, okay, encourage people to go out, try things, and deal with the failure. That's the best corrective to any kind of false, brittle pride, any kind of fake, puffed up self-image, which is what we're getting at with the term narcissism. Narcissism, and there are a lot of things you can say about narcissism in the bad sense, but part of narcissism is just trying to make your self-image invulnerable. And the quickest way to do that is just not to have a real life where anything challenges your self-image. If you actually get out and try and live a real life, your illusions are knocked out of you quickly enough. False pride is humbled, but real pride takes its place as you overcome that. And I think that that's really healthy. But that's a great question. Thank you so much for that question. Let me see. There's a few other questions here over on Telegram. Let me just find them. From Slusheet is, should convicted criminals be required to do the jobs Americans won't do, such as telemarketing, to cover the costs of their incarceration? Well, that's hilarious, actually. I was just thinking, you know, maybe the help centers should be staffed by convicted criminals, but then, you know, their language skills probably wouldn't be any better than the Indian call center people anyway. So I do think that the basic principle that prisoners should work is a good one. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I would say that criminals being put to a use is pretty much a general good, although it depends on the country we're talking about. For example, in the United States, we know what demographic makes up the majority of criminals there, incarcerated criminals there. In Britain, it seems to be the case that foreign Muslim men are now just completely dominating the incarceration situation. So I don't know how many good uses people like that can be put to, but I wouldn't have any objection to making them telemarketers or something from their prison cells. That sounds fine.
I just don't think they'd have very much success, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So I have a question from Gadius Maximus, our friend Gadius. Conservatives get ridiculed for delusional claims like MLK was a conservative and would vote Republican. Yet some on the right act like it's stupid to claim Marx would have been on board with woke. We have living examples of leftists and even right-wing politicians and intellectuals evolving into accepting woke. It only stands to reason that Marx or any other communist socialist of the past would accept woke. Well, you know, you're right. Marx might, if you transported him to the early 21st century, this could be a good comedy, couldn't it? Marx showing up in the 21st century, there would be a period of time when he would be a little bit taken back. If you're honest, if it's honest, good comedy, there'd be a lot of stuff he'd be surprised by, including a lot of politically incorrect stuff that we'd probably come out with. But I think by the end of it, he'd be with the program. He'd evolve. He'd evolve because I think, you know, that he'd see that these are his children. These are his children. But anyway, or his grandchildren, his great-grandchildren. But yeah, I think that's a good point. Yeah. Let's see if there are other questions.
I was going to say, there's certainly nothing quite as funny as reading what some of the old school communists had to say about some of the pets, the teachers' pets of today's woke movement. You know, some of the things that Che Guevara said about blacks, it's more based than some of the things that get said by, you know, virulent right wingers. So that's always tickles me to read what some of the old communist figures said about blacks or gays or anything of the other demographics that are protected or cherished by the wokesters.
Well, I think you should market T-shirts with Che's picture on it and some based comments about black people. That could be very interesting. That would be interesting to watch the cognitive dissidence.
One of the ones that he said was something like, he said something like, after the revolution will give as much consideration to the black man as the black man contributed to the revolution, which is to say nothing at all.
That's interesting. Yeah, okay. Board Troll has donated one lemon. Thank you very much. I'm checking to see if we have some questions here. Eric has written in with a few of his questions. Let me just see here. I'll just ask one of these. What's my favorite film franchise? For example, Star Wars, Lord of the Rings, James Bond, Alien, etc. Definitely, I don't know if I'd call it a franchise. Well, this is a good question, right? The first three Lord of the Rings movies are fantastic, and I love them. Then he did The Hobbit and mucked it all up. and now we've got Rings of Power. So I guess it depends on whether you can sort of draw a line and say here but no further, right? Yeah. What are your thoughts on that? Do you have a favorite?
Well, yeah, I am reluctant to use the word franchise to refer to.
I like to use the word mythos.
Yeah. When it comes to Tolkien's Legendarium, everything that he wrote and all the adaptations of it, yeah, I don't like to use the word franchise because it just sounds like a fast food restaurant chain. It sounds like McDonald's franchise. But it is true that the Peter Jackson films, including the first three, spawned raft of video games and other things like that. And then he made the three bloated films about The Hobbit, which I've never been able to sit through entirely because I don't like them at all. Now it looks like, so Rings of Power I would exclude from the Jackson quote-unquote franchise because that's Amazon's thing, but was horrible. And now it looks like Warner Brothers and New Line Cinema and all the other institutions and enterprises that are, you know, have some sort of stake in Tolkien's works, they've all reached a deal to make new films, theatrical cinematic adaptations. So the franchise will expand. I guess there's no escaping it yet. The word is apt, even though it does ring a bit like a sort of smarmy snake oil salesman type thing. But yeah, I think the first three Lord of the Rings films are very good. Pretty much the only films that I go back and watch and rewatch, because usually once I've seen a film, I won't rewatch it too many times. It has to be a really, really good one for me to rewatch it and still get enjoyment out of it. And in particular, The Fellowship of the Ring is one of those films.
I rewatch that trilogy once a year, usually around Christmas time.
Yep. Yeah, same here.
And I just get drawn into it over and over again. I think it's absolutely fantastic. And yeah, there are changes from the Tolkien. I hadn't read the Tolkien in so long. When I saw the movies, they were really fresh and they made a very strong impression on me. And I went back and reread The Lord of the Rings and said, yeah, well, this is different. This is different.
Some of the changes are quite good. I think some of the changes they made in the films work really well.
Making Frodo a young man, I thought was a great change.
In particular, I just think The Fellowship of the Ring is the best paced movie. It's over 3 hours long, but it flies by. And everything is so well blocked. Every time you go back and rewatch that, it's like sitting in a comfortable armchair. Mm-hmm. And it's not because you know it's going to happen, but it's because the story unfolds. It truly just unfolds. You watch it unfold, unravel, but in a very coherent way. You know that after this scene, they're going to go here and they're going to meet these characters, and meeting these characters is going to cause them to go on this journey to this place. And because they go to that place, something tragic is going to happen. It's going to force them to go to this place. And it's just a very nice story to follow along as an audience member. And some of the things that they had to eliminate from the books, mostly, were they were eliminations of the books, not so much changes or additions. For example, not including Tom Bombadil. Massive, massive choice. But they weren't the first to do that. Tom Bombadil, sadly, seems to be always left out, even though he's such a powerful character. He always gets left out of the adaptations. But it's because in the book, you can do this in a book, the whole section with Tom Bombadil is a massive detour.
Yeah.
It really doesn't have much to do with the journey. It doesn't have much to do with the quest. It doesn't have much to do with even the story, really. They do get daggers given to them because of that detour that eventually are very influential, even in the last book. But apart from that, nothing really happens there that is necessary to the rest of the narrative. So I think it's always a shame to leave him out, but it works.
Yeah. One thing that I didn't like was the loss of the scouring of the Shire.
Mm-hmm.
That I thought was so potently political, and that was removed. That was unfortunate for me. I thought that would have been quite
Yeah, cool. And to be honest, I do think that the quality of the films decreases. I'm not the biggest fan. I love the films, and I taken as a whole, the three of them together, they are great. But the Fellowship for me is just vastly superior. Because the second and third films, it's when the decisions to not just leave out things, but to add things and to change things drastically no longer seem to reflect the necessities of filmmaking or adapting something like Lord of the Rings to film. They seem more like indulgences. What they did to Christopher Lee, they really did him dirty by eliminating him from the final cut. And then in the final cut, the way that they depicted Saruman's demise is just comical. It's cringe. And then the scouring of the Shire, I mean, it would have been hard to do it. You've already, even in the final cinematic version, you have at least five moments where the audience thinks the film is over and the credits are going to roll. So then, I mean, it's a difficult ask to get a cinematic audience to go through the climax of defeating Sauron and then hang on for what could be another half an hour of having to deal with the other villain. It's not an easy thing to do with filmmaking.
So Eric has another question here, which I think is actually a good question. I'm going to modify it somewhat. He asks, what are some of your favorite film endings? That's a good question. What are some of my favorite film endings? I'd also raise the question, are there any great films that have disappointing endings? Do you have any thoughts on that, Pox?
Yeah, I could a lot, but the names are coming to me. But it's amazing how many films get the final act wrong.
And they're still good. One example of a great film that has a somewhat disappointing ramshackle ending is Michael Powell's The Red Shoes. I think it's a fantastic movie, but it just has a kind of ramshackle, needlessly tragic ending that, it's hard. It's hard to enjoy it, but I still enjoy the movie tremendously. Another story, and it's not just a movie, but the original novel has this problem too, that has a I think, a turn for the worse at the end is Fight Club. Because I don't like the idea that, oh, Tyler Durden just becomes like a psychological projection, right? It's like the Wizard of Oz movie where she wakes up and it was all a dream. No, that's not the original book. And I don't like that this very compelling story and character at the end just becomes a dream. That almost, well, it almost, that is a retreat from the radicalism of the film. They pull their punches at the very end. So those are two endings that I think are of great films that are still somewhat disappointing.
Yeah, Fight Club, I think, was actually would be one that I would say. Two Christopher Nolan films come to mind. Now, I didn't really like the second Batman film with the Joker in general, but I particularly didn't like the final act. Now, some people might say that that's still a good film. Okay, but the final act I thought was really poorly done. And then The Prestige. I really do like that film. But I don't know. There's something about the ending that just is kind of like a bit anticlimactic, maybe. It could have been a bit more, kind of have much more of an effect, I think.
I thought it was a very fine film, but I don't like it for some reason. And don't know what it is, but it's in part, it's the way it's paced at the end, I think. But yeah, in terms of film that has a really great end, well, two early M. Night Shyamalan films have great twists. One is, of course, oh God, I'm blanking out the name now. I See Dead People.
Yeah.
And the other is Unbreakable. And in fact, I like Unbreakable better than The Sixth Sense. I watch Unbreakable about once a year, too. Always find an occasion to put it on because I think it's just aesthetically a gorgeous film to look at. And it's great because it's a comic book film, but it's filmed like an art film. And the punch is when you realize, oh, this really is a superhero film at the end. It just the style, sets you up for that to be a surprise. And I think it's an absolutely brilliant film. And it's an absolutely brilliant film about masculinity, too.
Because you've seen it many times, have you picked up on what they did to really hammer home to the audience that the villain, the bad guy, really is a bad guy? He really is bad, not just because he, you know, barges into people's homes and kills them and chains them to radiators and things like that. But do you remember that when Bruce Willis' character brushes up against him and starts seeing aspects of his life, his villainous life, there's the scene where it might be the killer or it might be just some other villainous person. But he's brushing up against all the people at the train station. And because he's making contact with them, he's getting to see all of their sins, basically. And it might be the main, you know, the killer at the end, or it might just be some other person who brushes up against him. But one of the sins that were shown is this guy in a pickup truck full of other, you know, hooligans. They drive past some black people and they throw a beer bottle at them and he shouts, "Go back to Africa." And that's supposed to be like the clearest sign. Oh, he committed a racism. He must be bad.
Yeah, well, there are some things in that sort of subvert the racist narrative thing. For instance, one thing that I really liked was that the football stars are all white in this. You'd think that, well, this would be a great opportunity for some diversity casting, right? And they didn't do that. But yeah, I thought it was a great movie about masculinity being suppressed in this overly feminized society. And you literally have a man who's superhuman strength and he's a superhero. And he spends 20 years of his life slowly turning into this self-loathing schlub because his wife was worried about him getting hurt. It's like, no. This is crazy. And of course, their relationship goes awry, too. They're sleeping in separate beds. But once he gets in touch with his inner hero, suddenly there's fire again. So there are a lot of sort of manosphere
truths in there. Ubermensch.
Yeah, he literally picks her up and carries her off to the bedroom. Yeah. Yeah, you know,
that's a good film. I really like that one.
Yeah, too. I love old movies. Here's a goal for young males who feel a little bit repressed. Watch old movies where men get slapped in the face.
Yeah,
and ask yourself: will you ever be put in a position in life where a woman will slap you in the face? Maybe if not, maybe you're doing something wrong. Maybe you're being a little too nice. But yeah. Anyway, so those are good questions, actually, Eric. Movie questions always get good discussions going. Okay, I have an email here from our longtime commentator, Sutton. This comes at the very end, so it's a bit late. Have I been following the Milo Scammy Davis Jr. Fuentes blow up? And do I have any thoughts on it? I have been following this. Have you been following this? Do you know what he's referring to, Pox?
I think I do. I haven't been following it, but it's kind of unavoidable in these circles. Anything that Fuentes and co. get up to, you just kind of hear about it or see snippets of it. It's inevitable.
Yeah.
But go ahead, take it away.
Well, just have a few thoughts on it. Okay, first of all, the motives of all these people can be impugned. Okay. But that is a side issue. The substance of it is very, very serious. The substance of it is that this guy, Ali Akbar or whatever, I just know him as Scammy Davis Jr. because that's the term that Jim Goad has coined. This Ali Akbar, weird-looking guy, didn't think that hillbillies should get involved in protesting the stolen election. I'm never going to forgive him for that. Well, it turns out that he's not only gay, but he is very much a predator who has a record of going after underage males. He's a creep. He's a sex pest and he's a predator. And if he's actually had sex with any of these people that he's been harassing, he's also a statutory rapist. Now, this was something that was known to Milo Yiannopoulos and it was something known to Nick Fuentes. And for whatever reasons, they sat on this and did not warn people that this guy was a predator in their circles, in their movement. And now, because Milo has been banished and exiled and thrown out of the Yay campaign and all this kind of stuff by Nick Fuentes, Milo has decided that he suddenly discovered that his conscience cannot allow this story to go unheard. Of course, he's known about this stuff for years and has said nothing about it until it suits him for his own personal vendetta purposes. So he's not particularly concerned about the victims here, but he is raising a real scandal out of petty motives of personal revenge. And now it seems to have come out that, you know, Fuentes has acknowledged that, yeah, he knew about this stuff and he's just trying to, move on. There's nothing here. Fob people off with something lame. I don't think that he's going to survive this level of douchebaggery and hypocrisy. It's pretty bad. So, yeah, this is an interesting story. And again, all the people involved have really bad motives, yet the truth of the matter is that it seems pretty scandalous, and I think there's just going to be more and more of it coming up. Milo is the guy who flashed his vault, his external hard drive full of compromat on everybody that he's ever associated with. Years ago, he was warning people that he was this kind of person. I can't imagine what level of folly and arrogance led somebody like Fuentes to trust this guy. As for this Scammy Davis Jr. guy, the reason why Milo knows all about his creeping on teenage kids is, well, Scammy Davis Jr. shared it with Milo, thinking that Milo wouldn't wouldn't be all that disapproving. So it's just a real nest of absolutely scandalously horrible people. And I don't have anything more to say about it except that. I don't know even what Fuentes says about politics anymore. The only thing I hear from the Fuentes sphere are not political takes, it's just the latest scandals. And that, I think that's just all it is. And if you think that the movement is best being just sort of a sideshow full of freaks and drama, you know, more power to you. But honestly, my advice is just tune out of all these people. There was a poll that was put out by Keith Woods the other day. Mm-hmm. And I'll give Keith props when he does something good. This was a poll asking people what they do to support their political views. And thousands of people responded to it. And 31% said that they do nothing to promote their political views. Okay, well, what are you doing? Well, they're basically just consuming content online. They're passively consuming content. This is just entertainment. And I think probably the 31% are very much caught up with this kind of empty, disgusting e-drama that America First has descended into. It's shameful, though, that given, okay, our little circle, our little sphere, our little movement believes that some things are terribly wrong, that things are moving in absolutely dystopian, apocalyptic directions. And if you actually believe that and 31% of you do nothing, I question the seriousness of this. I fear that there are not enough serious people to save the world. And when there are people who are involved in this and presumably red pill to whatever level that they're answering this poll, and 3 out of 10 do nothing. That's sobering. That's a very useful poll to have. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, we discussed that poll last night on a stream I did. There was some very good analysis of it. And then I also saw that for the mid-year, I also gave some analysis of it, you know, giving some of the respondents the benefit of the doubt. You know, because we do live in occupied territory and you are sticking your neck out there if you decide to, especially publicly showing your face or using your real name, you know, make the kind of content that we make. Or if you are
two of the options were simply donating money or reinforcing people's message on social media. That's pretty low risk.
Exactly. No, I was just saying, so there's some doubt, benefit of the doubt to be given. But then there were other options that were, very basic stuff. Like you're not even retweeting, you know, you're not even doing anything like that or talking to friends and family about our ideas, trying to, you know, persuade some people to think more along our lines instead of whatever, you know, CNN or the regime is telling them to think. So, yeah, that's kind of disappointing. Go ahead. Well, as far as the Fuentes stuff, speaking about benefit of the doubt, every time I try to give him the benefit of the doubt, every time I try to recognize something good that he's done, very quickly, short time after, there will be some new scandal or something else he's done that completely undermines the attempt that I was trying to give him to tip my hat. He is just surrounded with some of the worst people. And like you said, I don't even know what he's talking about as far as politics goes anymore. I saw him on this Ginger Girls podcast, and he was making some great points about lies from the Second World War. And she was a very kind host. It was a very almost wholesome exchange. If only all of our exchanges with people like, you know, normies about World War II stuff could be as wholesome and amicable. The worst of it is just, I'm so tired. This is why I've become very different regarding my thoughts on Christianity compared to just 2 years ago. Christianity is something I've grown up with. It's something I've always questioned. I used to always, you know, hang out after the sermon and have questions for the priest. I've read the Bible from Genesis to Revelation twice. Used to memorize entire passages, trained to memorize entire passages as I was growing up. But one of the things that annoys me whenever Christians try to use Christianity politically is just that it always descends into a nest of hypocrites. None of them live up to the Christian values that they are espousing. And so Gwyneth Fuentes goes on his cozy TV or whatever and talks about, you know, it gives these, you know, sort of caricature fire and brimstone sermons, but then he's knowingly associating with the exact same people that he's railing against. And then there's just all the weird sex stuff, you know, it's comical. It's such a shame because when he's on point, he's very good. And I have a lot of people in my chat group and stuff that are Nick Fuentes fans. And people look at him sort of as a utilitarian, from a utilitarian way, and say, look, whenever he does something good, whenever, like the stuff he said with Yi on Alex Jones' show, okay, that was total clown world theater. But it got some normies thinking, yeah, you know, maybe there are a lot of Jews in Hollywood. Okay, now there's my chance to say why that might be a bad thing. And is it normal that such a small percentage of the population should have so much control over these industries? Okay, fair enough. But then what else is Nick Fuentes getting up to and the rest of these Christian nationalist types? And then how, because of their behavior, how easy are they making it to just set up these softballs for our adversaries to knock us out of the park? Like, look, you can't even, you're all Christian fundamentalists, you know, Christian nationalists, preaching, you know, hardcore Puritan morals, but you can't even keep sex pests out of your own thing. In fact, you knowingly keep
them
alive.
They're not even trying.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's just fucking set up perfectly for the journo class and the shitlibs on Twitter to mock someone who's quite adjacent to us, actually. You know, I sometimes include,
yes,
Nick Fuentes in criticisms of the dissident right or things like that. And people say, is he really though? Or is he just off doing his own thing and the Christian nationalists, the American firsters, are a different thing? But well, they're quite adjacent. And they are so adjacent that whatever shenanigans they get up to, the damaging effects of that will bleed over towards us. So yeah, it's a shame. It's annoying that these things happen with him and his crew. I don't know. I guess it's a similar thing. The Zoomer is just not taking things seriously, I suppose.
Yeah, that's all quite well said. It's just disappointing and depressing. At this point, I have a slogan, which is don't trust anybody under 30. And I think it's a very reasonable slogan. Don't trust them, I mean, don't invest anything in them. Don't get your hopes up, right? And Fuentes is just, he's very talented, but he's incredibly immature and he's incredibly dishonest. He's obviously got severe personality disorders. He's very probably gay, which is going to present a problem for him running his rancidly homophobic movement with its gay leader. Of course, it might be his out. And I do think he's actually looking for an out. I think he's tired of America First. I think he's tired of doing all of his streams. This is why he's late all the time. It's either that or it's just some sort of Latin American kind of thing where, you know, the doctor in Peru won't take the first patient until the waiting room is full. Why? Because it makes him look like a big man when other people are waiting on him. And he might be purring with contentment just knowing that there are people waiting for him. And it's just like some pathetic, narcissism of the lowest sort. That might be what's going on there, right? But I just think he's looking for an out. And maybe his out will be, you know, finally he'll come out of the closet and his he'll have done something that for his constituency is so unforgivable that it's basically his out. It's his get out of jail free card, and he can go off and do something else. I think that that might be coming.
It's strange because it seemed like, and actually this is what people in his defense were saying. Because if you were to say that Nick Fuentes is basically just a sideshow gimmick, he's just an entertainer. I think Nick Fuentes is a terminally insincere person. But I think it has to do with what we were saying earlier. It's like the Zoomers are just afraid of sincerity. Everything has to be ironic. Everything has to be casual. Everything has to be sort of shallow because it's a self-defense mechanism and because sincerity is cringe for them. And so it's difficult to ever really know what Fuentes is serious about. But at one point, not too long ago, I guess a year or so ago, a couple of years ago, if you were to say that Nick Fuentes is basically just an entertainer, he's too mature, etc., the response would be, well, he's a 20-something kid who's created a political movement. And America First seemed to have designs on infiltrating the GOP, turning over the GOP. I don't know if they were going to try and become a political party. I think they realized that in America, you're basically stuck with the Democrats and the Republicans forever. So you have to infiltrate the Republican Party and transform it into your image. And they had, you know, political conferences with
interns. They were getting money. They were getting Congress people.
Yeah, I was going to say, people giving speeches. But then last I checked, there was like, they've now been feuding. So people, the crazy one, Marjorie, she was a speaker at one of these AFPAC things. Yeah. And she got the crowd all ginned up into chanting Christ is King and all that stuff. And I wasn't, you know, I don't follow too much of these people, but recently I saw that Nick Fuentes was completely lambasting her and mocking her in the way that he can, which is very cruel and very incisive. And I was amused because I thought, wait a second, I thought you guys were on the same team. I thought she gave a speech, you invited her to the AFPAC conference, and you all were chanting Christ is King together. What happened? I don't know what happened, but
I think
apparently
what happened
had a huge
is this.
Falling out.
I think that it got too big for him, and he felt burdened by it, and so he blew it up. This is why I think he's looking for exits. Suddenly, he just started going hard and heavy on the incel stuff and just the the freaky, gross, pizza-faced Zoomer internet, ass end of the internet cult stuff. And it was like he was trying, absolutely trying to do a complete 180 and get away from the mainstream as quickly as possible and burn all the bridges. And then the Ye thing came along. And I thought, maybe Ye will be his exit from America First. He'll be in the Ye campaign. Of course, that wasn't going to go anywhere in the long term. But I do think he's looking for an exit because, well, and here's another thing about him. I think he's quite sociopathic, and sociopaths are easily bored. This is one of their traits. They're easily bored. They don't have the ability to sustain long-term focused planning. And that's Fuentes up one side and down the other. He's very clever and he's very talented, but he's also sociopathic. And that means he treats the people around him badly. He surrounds himself with sycophants and freaks. And, you know, that's not a recipe for a good functioning organization. And he just doesn't have the ability to sustain long-term planning and work. Or motivate other people to do it for him. He can't even get other people to paint his fence for him. Because again, that entails treating people well. So I just don't think he's got the personality to create a political movement. And he realized that, and he's looking for exits. And of course, he's going to be zigging and zagging in the most spectacular way possible, trying to get as much publicity as he can, because that's part of his shtick. And I have to admit that having dinner with the president, or the former president, the rightful president of the United States at Mar-a-Lago, was a real coup on his part. There's no question about it. But yeah, I
But it's one a shame that he's not using that for any purpose. Like, if I'm not mistaken, America First has, it seems to have given up any of its intentions of transforming the GOP and getting America First people in Congress. So having dinner with an ex-president and who could be president again, well, that was just boost his ego, I guess, or to have a cool story to tell on one of his streams next day. But it's not been useful for anything important.
It's just superficial, and everything is just superficial. It's just all likes and clicks and, you know, being at the center of attention and stuff like that. You know, you don't change the world with personalities like that. You just waste people's time. And we've been wasting 20 minutes of our time and our readers' time talking about it, which I guess is very profoundly satisfying to him. He might be purring in satisfaction that we've wasted 20 minutes of our lives talking about him. There's one thing about the sexual impropriety thing. It always seems to go with cult dynamics. Mm. Cults of personality don't just happen. They're cultivated by people with personality disorders. And when you get a cult of personality, one of the things that happens is you get all kinds of sexual shenanigans going on too. It's just the way it is. And it's just one of the red flags that there's a whole cult dynamic going on there. One more question. Miko wrote in, and let me just give you the gist of the question so I don't have to look for it. He basically said something like this. When somebody is a gateway to the mainstream, shouldn't we basically lay off the criticisms of them? Right? And my answer is no, that's not how it works. If somebody is a gateway drug or is a, you know, you can, okay, I had a recent conversation about this with some friends about Jordan Peterson. Mm-hmm. Jordan Peterson is sort of adjacent to us. He has a large audience. He says a few good things. Shouldn't we lay off him? Mm-hmm. Shouldn't we not say mean things about Jordan Peterson? I don't know. Thank you for your service, Jordan, or whatever. But no, because he won't function as a gateway unless we criticize him. Because the purpose of going after somebody like Jordan Peterson, who has a huge audience with really cutting memes and really trenchant, cogent, well-argued critiques too, is that they have a huge audience, and when they get entertained, what am I saying? When they get attacked, when they get criticized, some of that huge audience is going to find out about it. Why? Because there's this swirl of activity around these people on the internet. That's how people find out about it. That's how people find out. That's why we're talking about Fuentes. You know, I haven't ever followed him, but there's just this swirl of activity and talk about him. So I can't help but be exposed to it. Well, if you go after Jordan Peterson with some good memes or well-argued criticisms, people are going to notice that. And what we want to do to get people further along in their red pill journey is to attract the audience of people like Jordan Peterson and show that, yes, congratulations on your journey so far. However, there's a whole bunch more stuff that you need to consider here. That's how we use these people. That's how we use these people as gateways. If we don't criticize them, it's basically, it's fair to call them.
They're not gateways. They're just gatekeepers.
They're gatekeepers. Exactly. I always thought this sort of paranoid discourse, oh, he's a gatekeeper. Well, he's only as much of a gatekeeper as you allow him to be, right? If we have a certain amount of will to power here, will to represent ourselves, to take our own sides, and we go after these people, and again, you can be really mean and funny, or you can be really fair, but cuttingly critical and rational. Either way, I prefer both. You know, we should hit them with everything we've got. It's by hitting them that we actually turn them into a gateway to our side. So it's a false opposition, you know. We should both respect these people as gateways and attack them, because it's precisely by attacking them that they become the gateway.
I say, you know, it depends on who exactly you're talking about, because this could even be done amongst ourselves. where because you don't entirely agree with someone, or because you disagree with them on something very near and dear to you, you end up attacking them. Now, fair enough. It's fair enough to say, don't say something too critical or, you know, too destructively critical about someone in the mainstream who can be useful as a conduit to our stuff. But I think it's worth saying then who exactly we're talking about. So like someone like Mark Stein, I think, okay, he's probably not entirely on our side of things. But I don't know if I would go very hard on him because he doesn't, at least to my knowledge, not recently, perhaps in the past, but I don't see him intentionally trying to gatekeep us.
Right.
Now, if we were to talk about someone like Tucker Carlson, I've shared many Tucker Carlson clips. He has, I think, very good writers that type up these monologues that he gives at the beginning of his shows. And on many occasions, he says things very concisely. He explains a lot of what's going on in a 3-minute clip that I can post, and it goes viral. Or at least it gets seen by a lot of people on, you know, third tier platforms like Telegram. But my honest opinion of Tucker Carlson is that he is slimy. And I can't think of anyone worse than someone like Tucker Carlson, who on a nightly basis will tell his audience of mostly white Americans, white conservative Americans, just how bad things are getting in their country. And just how dangerous things are getting for them because they are white conservatives. And he will lead them like a forest ranger through the wilderness right up until he gets to the wolf's den. And then he abandons them. He abandons them and he takes away with him all of the tools and weapons they could have used to defend themselves from the wolves. Because he consistently says, fuck you to white identitarianism. Literally, he says that. Fuck you. White nationalism, fuck you. Anyone who's going to speak for a white collective, fuck you. And for a man who's apparently, you know, quite religious, for him to be using language like that when he's not on his Fox News show, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. But anyway, he most recently went on this sort of rant with some old comic who's now got a
Adam
podcast.
Adam Carolla.
But it's not the first time.
I've never heard him say anything funny. Did you see my article on this?
Yeah. But and it's not the first time that he's done that. It's not the first time. And I think that actually that deserves so much criticism. Vicious criticism, because what he's doing is shameful. The reason he has become so powerful, so influential, the most watched pundit on American cable news is because he spoke honestly. Well, he speaks, you know, he still does it. He speaks honestly about what is going on in America, why America is failing rapidly. And he's basically speaking our talking points at various moments regarding BLM stuff, regarding the target placed on the backs of white people with critical race theory and anti-white racism. He has used that expression, anti-white racism.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, then if you're being attacked because you are white, in America, and then the solution to that is to say, hey, well, then maybe we need to have the same kind of protections and representation that blacks get, that Muslims get, that the gays get, etc. Well, no, now here comes Tucker to say, no, all of that is identitarianism, it's identity politics, it's collectivism. No white person should be able to speak for anyone else just on the basis of skin color. He keeps reducing it to skin color. It's just such a gatekeeping tactic.
Well,
and it's disgusting. I see that and I think you are so slimy. So of course he deserves criticism. And Jordan Peterson, likewise.
Jordan Peterson, I publicly said I hate this guy the other day. And yeah. We got this conversation going. He's going around saying, you know, the new Muslim Pakistani or whatever he is, first minister of Scotland, is a white person.
First he asked, how is he not white? And then he doubled down from asking how is he not white to now just explicitly saying he is white.
Well, surely he's as white as any Irishman.
Exactly.
And I just thought, okay, this goes, it's calculatedly destructive and evil. Okay. To basically to say, okay, this person is white, or how dare you say this person isn't white? And then to when he's challenged on this, engage in some, you know, petty intra-white rivalry, right?
Well, it's the same, you know, sort of shit lib wankery that you get from, you know, he's basically doing what is a woman. So it's all well and good to mock the left because they don't know how to define a woman. But here you are, you don't know how to define a European, a white
right.
man.
Right.
So to the point now where you're saying that a Pakistani Muslim who wore traditional Pakistani Muslim garb on his inauguration day is white, is Scottish. In fact, people were commenting under his posts, even worse takes than his, saying, oh, I disagree with you, doctor. It's perhaps not accurate to say that he's white. Better to say that he's Scottish.
Yeah.
For me, that's actually worse.
That's actually worse. Yeah. It's like, okay, they're just one-upping one another in dishonesty.
Yeah.
And that's basically how multiculturalism is going to continue staggering along until it just becomes totally unsustainable and collapses. Is that instead of being honest and trying to fix the problems, you just have elites on public platforms trying to out-signal one another for stupidity and dishonesty. It's fiddling not, while no, Rome burns.
Jordan Peterson's not being entirely dishonest. What I mean to say is he knows what he's doing. This is a man who is preeminently concerned, worried about white people, Europeans, whether it's in America or in Europe or probably even South Africa and Australia. But he was certainly very concerned specifically about European identitarian movements and nationalism. He
oh, yeah.
does not want that to happen. His whole purpose is to get men, white men, to see the failings of society around them. And then his solution is to give them, you know, the 12 rules of life and all that, and be an individual, be an atomized individual, clean your room, but do not collectivize, do not find strength and meaning and purpose in your identity as a Scot, as an Irishman, as a Spaniard, anything of that. And I always say this, but to any of the listeners who might not know that much about me, I've said this many times, that I liked Jordan Peterson, bought the book, read the book. I thought some of his, you know, discourses on psychology and, of course, his takedowns of feminism and his famous interview with that presenter on Channel 4, all that was great. But I saw him do something which made me quickly reconsider everything that I thought about him, and then I was even more quickly vindicated. When he sat down with Douglas Murray in 2018 and they sat on these massive leather armchairs, and I don't know if this video is still up on YouTube somewhere, it was an hour long, and I was expecting something great because this was at the same time too that I was really appreciative of Douglas Murray, and The Strange Death of Europe was a great book full of information, facts, interesting perspectives. It's a bestseller. Again, someone who's in the mainstream. We should be happy about this. And they sat, and the whole, almost the entire hour of their conversation was Douglas and Jordan kvetching about the potential rise of European nationalism, of the far right, of the identitarian right, in the face of the, you know, spate of terrorist attacks that occurred because of the quote-unquote migrant crisis and Angela Merkel bringing a bunch of Arabs and Africans into Europe. That was the content of their chinwag. Just let's worry, let's clutch pearls about Europeans who are on the ground having to deal with the consequences of all the things that you write books about and make lots of money giving speeches about. And now here you have actual Europeans dealing with that, and you're going
you don't
to
want that.
Undermine them.
Yeah.
And you're going to cast dispersions on them.
Yeah. You make money complaining about these problems, and then you shit on the people who are doing the natural things necessary to solve them.
To solve them or just even to protect themselves.
Yeah, to protect
themselves. This is what annoys me about Tucker. Not even annoys me. Disgusts me about what Tucker Carlson said and what Jordan Peterson does is that, okay, sure, they're undermining us. They're getting in the way of our solutions. But it's not even that. We're talking about like basic protection now. The kind of things that could protect little English girls from getting gang raped by grooming gangs of foreigners, patrolling their towns looking for fresh meat. Well, Douglas and Jordan and Tucker are actively, like I said in that analogy, they are running away after leading us to the wolf's den and taking all the weapons with them so that we have nothing to protect ourselves with. Because these mainstream voices have once again repeated the notion that most normies already have in their heads. So they've just reaffirmed it, that white people collectivizing, identifying based on their shared ethnic characteristics, their exclusive ethnic characteristics, seeing themselves as a group under threat and coming together to protect themselves. Well, no, that is basically Hitlerism all over again.
Yeah.
It's identity politics. You're no better than the woke left, blah, blah, blah. And that's all it takes for that white person to go, oh, you're right. No, I have to be an individual. We're all individuals. Right. And now they're back loose, alone in the wilderness with nothing to protect them.
Yeah. The only argument that you would get from somebody like Tucker Carlson against identity politics, woke identity politics, is that, well, okay, he is consistent. He's not like your mainstream Republicans who are happy to pander to minority identity politics, but be against white identity politics. He seems to want to say, I'm against all identity politics. But one of the arguments that these people give against identity politics is that you better go back to the old paradigm where we're just arguing about ideology, because if you keep going down this path, white people will start collectivizing and nothing is worse than that. Well, that just shows that ultimately they outsourced all their thinking to Jews a long time ago, because of course Jews are the people who believe that there's nothing worse in the world than white people collectivizing. And this is the great problem that we face. As long as we have outsourced our thinking to Jews and they have this deep antipathy to white collectivism for good reason, but they chose to be our enemies, then we're never going to get anywhere. And so
and all three, Douglas Murray, Tucker Carlson, and Jordan Peterson, the most recent, are all very deep in the pocket now of Israelis, of Jews, of Zionists. Douglas Murray's always been a neocon, always pro-Israel. Tucker Carlson, same thing. And now Jordan Peterson, well, he's just basically Ben Shapiro and Netanyahu's lapdog.
Yeah. Yeah, and it would be interesting if Tucker is really consistent about being opposed to all forms of identity politics. Is he opposed to Jewish identity politics? That would be the real test case, right? But here's the thing. If everybody is not willing to take that step back and just go back to ideological politics, not identity politics, then we can't afford not to engage in identity politics because we'll simply lose it all. Again, it's just basic game theory.
Greg, what do you think about this? Like, ever since I even heard the term identity politics, it always struck me as a bit strange, because for me, all politics is based ultimately on identity. Whether it's your class identity, your religious identity, your ethnic identity, all politics has something to do with your identity. What do these people want? Just blank slate ideas, ideologues, but then they also rail against ideologues. So it's like, what are you bitching about?
Yeah, well, there is something contradictory. It's the same sort of contradiction of the lovey-dovey liberals. We don't want to have any enemies except for you. You know, you are the enemy, right? The people who are against world peace, as they conceive it, are the enemy. There's always going to be an enemy, right? Mm. And yeah, what do they want to stand for? Well, basically what they want is for everybody to be an individualist and only think of himself as an individual. And if there's going to be a permissible range of political opinions, they have to be on ideological points rather than identity points. And so it's center left versus center right. It's, you know, tinkering with the welfare state, stuff like that. It's all has to be matters of degree, ultimately, because that's what liberal democracy requires. It's just the politics of quantity, because you can't compromise on absolute principles. It's all got to be just a compromise on numbers, right?
It seems like a reduction of politics to just economic matters, but that's not politics.
Liberalism. That's liberalism. That's what liberalism wants to be. Carl Schmitt is wonderful about this in his Crisis of Liberal Democracy. Basically, what liberalism does is it gets rid of the idea that there's a common good of society that statesmen can pursue that would contradict and supervene upon and provide limits for individual interests and individual self-seeking. They just want to eviscerate politics from that notion of the common good and of statesmanship in pursuit of the common good. Well, what does that lead to? Well, it leads to politicians still going through the motions of making policy, but instead of in the parliament, right, having a conversation that allows you to come to a consensus that somehow tracks the common good, the talk in the chamber just becomes a farce because there's nothing that it can aim at. And so what happens is instead of making policy in the parliament through discourse, you make policy in the lobby through bidding, basically. And so what happens is politicians, if there's no common good of society, what are they out for? Their individual good. And the best they can do is say, well, if everybody's selfish, things will all work out in the end, invisible hand, et cetera, et cetera. So if they're just going to be selfish, what does that boil down to? It means they become pitchmen for the pharmaceutical companies or pitchmen for the military industrial complex. Basically, all policy is bought, right? And therefore, politics just becomes a bourse. It's just a market. Mm-hmm. And that's
what seems to be that's where we're at.
Yeah. That's our fate. And they want us to stay there rather than work our way out of that. Because, of course, it's all superficial. And it can only work if identity issues are not salient. And the best way that identity issues are not salient is that you have liberalism in one country and it's very fairly homogeneous, right? But you get a minority or an outgroup, a parasite tribe that's trying to hack your individualist game or whatever, eventually all that's going to come crashing down. Because again, individualist games lose to people who cheat and play as teams.
Yeah.
Well, hey, we've been going on for more than 2 hours. We're verging on 3. So as much as I enjoy this, I think we should probably wrap up. Pox, thank you for this. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. As always, it was a pleasure.
Yeah. And thank you, everyone out there, the donors, the people in the chats, our moderators. We have such a good audience that our moderators don't even need to moderate anymore. They just put links. And I think it's wonderful. It's a nice, tight,
good,
well-oiled machine that we have and a really great audience here. So thank you all. I will be back next week with another episode of Countercurrents Radio. I'm trying to figure out exactly who is going to be the guest. I think it'll probably be determined by the latest current thing, but we will definitely be back. So thank you very much.